Last year, we were pleased to welcome Mr. Bill Blakey, Member of Parliament, and the longest-serving Member of Parliament, actually, to speak to us. And this year, we are delighted to welcome Mr. Ian Benson. Now, the purpose of the forum is to bring the finest thinkers on the demanding issues and themes associated with the intersection of religion and public life, to bring them to Camrose, to bring them to Alberta, so that we can understand their ideas clearly, think together about the implications of what it is they've had to say, and consequently learn to think much more, in a much more textured way, about what are often ideas that become captive of one ideological preserve or another. Our intention is to provide a place which is hospitable to all serious perspectives for the sake of civil life. The forum gives us an opportunity to do this work in the public square. And as at least some of you are aware, the center also works in the academy and in and with a variety of religious communities, all with an eye to deepening our understanding of the capacity of religious traditions to think clearly about these issues and themes, and to do what is best on behalf of the civil life as well as on behalf of their own communities. Tonight, I want to also welcome the Honorable Leroy Johnson, the MLA for Camrose-Wetaskiwin. Camrose and Wetaskiwin are, as I've come to learn, I had only an inkling of this as a child, but it is a rivalry to match that of Edmonton and Calgary, which is a couple of small places not far from here. And Leroy Johnson's work, in many ways, has made Augustana and the continuance of Augustana possible as part of the University of Alberta and was central to the birth of the Chester Ronning Center. I cannot do anything but pause for a moment to remember tonight his beloved wife, Diane, who departed this fragile world of ours all too soon. And I know from the people that I have talked with that her companionship to Leroy has made their life fruitful and his work so fruitful, and that her friendship with so many has made this place a holy place. So, Leroy, a few words.
Thank you very much, David. David and I go back quite a few years. I was born and raised in New Norway, and I'm not sure if you were born in Camrose, but you were raised here anyway, and there was a rivalry between New Norway and Camrose, too, even though we were quite close. Thank you for mentioning Diane, my wife. We both were students at Augustana, and I've had a long history with Augustana. I was on staff here for 30 years after being a student, so I have a very, very strong feeling for Augustana and this place. You mentioned that I'm the MLA for Camrose-Wetaskiwin and the rivalry between Camrose and Wetaskiwin. I must correct you, it's Wetaskiwin-Camrose, because if I don't do that, someone might be here and remind me of that. But people in Camrose like to think of it as Camrose-Wetaskiwin, and of course at Wetaskiwin it's Wetaskiwin-Camrose. But I am delighted to be in public life. It's a wonderful life, and I certainly rely upon the associations I've had here at Augustana and the many people that I know here for a lot of advice. And I want to thank so many of you that are here tonight that came out to support our family at Diane's funeral in September. I want to, first of all, bring you greetings from our Premier, our new Premier. This is the second greeting to this constituency that I've been able to bring from our new Premier, Premier Ed Stelmach, who, of course, is a neighboring MLA. And we're quite excited about his leadership. I also want to bring you greetings from our new Minister of Advanced Education and Technology, the Honorable Doug Horner. An invitation has been extended to Doug Horner to be here on April 30th when the University, Augustana Faculty, University of Alberta, gives its yearly message, I guess, to the community. I believe there's a name for it, but I just forget. But anyway, it's a night where the university talks to the community about what's happened the past year. And the Honorable Doug Horner will be here at that time. I might say that the work that you do, David, here is very much appreciated. I appreciate it especially. You do give me a phone call quite often, and we talk about things, and I really do appreciate that. The Center for Religion and Public Life, it seems to me, is so important. And I know that the two people that I brought greetings from, Ed Stelmach and Doug Horner, are very, very interested in this, considering their backgrounds. You know, when you consider this institution, and as I look around, I see that many of you have had a close and long association with Camrose Lutheran College or Augustana University College, or now the Augustana faculty of the University of Alberta. You've had a long association here with this institution, which is around 95 years old or thereabouts, soon to celebrate its centennial. And religion has played such a leading role, such an important role in the development of this institution. That's why it was really established in the first place, to teach the catechism and the Lutheran faith to young people that were coming from the old country at that time, I guess you might say. So over the years, that's been the constant, really, religion and Christianity, and of course mainly Lutheranism here. So it's as the merger took place, it's so gratifying that we've hung on to that tradition. And it's up to you, David, I guess, as the head of this center to continue to develop that. Because it was an issue. We all know it was an issue as the merger took place. How do we hang on to these traditions? And that was a concern of the church. So let me commend you for what you're doing in that regard. But religion and public life to me is a life of leadership and service, and I don't know how you can separate that from religion, at least the Christian religion. So it seems to me that they go so well together. You know, that's been an issue over the ages, I guess, and so we talk about things like separation of church and state, for example, and we just talk about that, and we really don't know what it means, but we think it should be separated, I guess. Well, I don't think it should be, but maybe it should be. And it just seems to me that these are some of a topic like this is something that you can grapple with, and we can see how they can actually merge together and be supportive of one area, supportive of the other. So my congratulations to you for maintaining, first of all, this tradition and marrying it with what public life is all about. And then let me congratulate you also for naming it the Chester Ronning Center, because I think that Chester Ronning in so many ways exemplifies what we're really talking about here. So I really do appreciate that. When I was asked to come tonight, I asked who the speaker would be, and then I asked what the topic would be. And it seems like it's quite an interesting topic, living together with disagreement. I immediately thought, well, that's probably for me as a politician, because that seems to be what politics is all about, and I guess our whole system is based on that, government and opposition. And if we do agree on something, then I guess we're supposed to disagree because the opposition takes another side. So, from all of that, I guess a better result comes out. So I was just thinking that, you know, disagreement isn't necessarily bad. It really leads to a better result, at least in the field that I'm working with, yes. But maybe this topic only applies to politics. But I think it probably applies to religion too, theology. I think there's some disagreement there. And, you know, our whole judicial system, there's kind of based upon an opposing view as well. And, you know, I hear a lot about the environment these days, and there's sure a lot of disagreement there. And, you know, all the farmers around have their views too. So what a wonderful topic. It I'm sure has a lot for all of us in whatever area we may work in and whatever our views may be. So, Mr. Benson, I want to welcome you to Alberta and welcome you to my constituency and Camrose, and certainly look forward to what you have to say on this very interesting topic. Thank you.
Thank you, Leroy. Living together with disagreement, pluralism, the secular, and the fair treatment of beliefs in Canada today. Ian Benson is the executive director of the Centre for Cultural Renewal in Ottawa and manages the research and publication priorities of the centre. He's a barrister and a solicitor. He practiced privately for a number of years, became the senior solicitor for the BC Labour Relations Board. Ian studied at universities in Canada, Scotland, England, back in the grand old days. I think what he is most famous for is a year living off his busking with his wife throughout Europe. At least I've heard the story. I have no idea about its veracity. His interests, and part of what has interested me in Ian's work, is that his interests really cross the areas of philosophy, law, theology, history, medical ethics. He practices constitutional administrative law and has appeared before the courts in Canada at virtually all levels. I don't think there is anyone else in the country that has tracked and commented on and explored and analyzed court cases as systematically as Ian has over the last decade and a half or so, court cases where religion and public life are at issue. He has also done work in the UK, South Africa, and Saudi Arabia. So I am delighted that Ian is with us tonight and that he is going to open up for us what is a very demanding area for us to think about. He will be exploring how all citizens are in some sense believers of one sort or another, whether they are religious or atheist or agnostic. He will be exploring the nature of the secular itself and arguing that that needs to be re-understood as one of the competing belief systems within a pluralistic society. And of course, the nature of the public in line with this understanding of religiously inclusive society is at work, as well as the issue of fairness and the dangers of a kind of convergent liberalism, which he will argue, as he has done on many occasions with me, as dangerously illiberal. So I'm delighted you're here. And I can tell you that you have a wonderful group of people that are going to follow every thought and word. and engage you in conversation about it. So thank you so much for coming. Welcome. Ian Benson.
Well, thank you very much. I heard quite a bit about David Goa before I ever met him. And I think that it's a great honor to be here at the Chester Ronning Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life. That kind of study on the relationship between something as important to societies as religion and the interface between religions and public life is terribly needed in Canada at the moment. And so it's a delight for me to be here for the first time ever in Camrose, and to be back again in Alberta, and particularly to be part in a small way of the work that David Goa and Dietmar Mundell and others are doing at your important center. So it's an honor to be here. Thanks for the invitation. The topic of the discussion this evening, and it's very much more than my paper, fortunately, because I'm looking forward to the second part, which is the conversation that will take place here around more general themes and more relaxed engagement. I think that might be more useful for all of us than what I'm about to say in the opening session. But I thought it might be useful for you, given my background in the law and some of these cases, to have some more sort of dry theoretical stuff against which to build the more interesting conversation that will follow it. So what I propose to do is take a very dry, but I hope useful paper on some themes related to the law and religion in Canada, and more importantly, some themes in contemporary political theory touching on the nature of liberalism, to try and get at some of the pressure points that are being brought to bear on the roles of religion, particularly in culture. And let me start with a bold claim. I think we sit at a moment of great opportunity in Canada to actually be part of a paradigm shift in how we think about the relationship between competing belief systems in a civil society. We've inherited a great deal of problematical baggage in terms of how we think about the world around us. And a lot of the way we think about society and the state is based on what I would argue are false dichotomies. And so that we think in terms of the separation of church and state in a particular way, rather than in another way. We could look at the cooperation of church and state rather than the separation of church and state. That phrase, cooperation of church and state, is actually a more accurate way of viewing what I think the relationship should be. Separation implies, as indeed many people argue, a rigid non-engagement between the two. Cooperation, as the name implies, suggests a relationship, but nonetheless a distinction between the two spheres. And I think the cooperation of church and state is a Canadian way of viewing it. We don't need to step into the shoes of our neighbors to the south in language which may have suited their cultural history, but it doesn't suit ours. It's very clear from Canadian, the history of religion in Canada, that our educational frameworks and our healthcare frameworks, just to name two, were primarily built upon religious projects. And what we inherit today, what we continue to have as a society, is built upon those cooperative religious and state grounds. And indeed, our Constitution recognizes that. Section 93 of the Constitution Act of 1867 expressly sets out the protection for denominational schooling. No such provision in the United States, just to name a sharp distinction. Our funding arrangements, underneath that section, specifically allow public funding of denominational education. So Canada doesn't have these sharp bifurcations. Yet, the baggage that I referred to a minute ago is in deeper waters. It's in the way we speak about the relationship between different kinds of citizens. For example, everybody, whether religious or non-religious, uses the language of believers and unbelievers. Everybody, whether religious or not, speaks about religion and the secular. Everybody speaks about religion and the public. And I would like to suggest that these last usages are deeply erroneous, and that in fact the paradigm shift to properly evaluate how we ought to live together as citizens who are believers of different sorts requires us to overcome those false dichotomies. Why? Well, proposition number one, to be human is to be a believer. That's not an issue. The question is, what do we believe in, not whether we believe. So, in this reading, which I think is accurate philosophically, atheists and agnostics are also believers. Their beliefs are oriented in different directions. They load what they believe in different ways, maybe don't attribute those beliefs to theological ends or beginnings, but nonetheless, they're believers. Similarly, religions are a kind of organization of beliefs, and other citizens have their own kinds of organizations of beliefs that need to be seen as akin to the religious role. Ironically, some of them, like the Canadian Humanist Association, has argued for years that it should be accorded the same benefits as religion in terms of tax status exemptions, because it says we're believers too, we just don't believe in God. And to that extent, I think they're right. Now, therefore, for religious people who believe religion is important, but also believe religion should be part of the common enterprise of culture, to speak about believers and unbelievers, or to speak about communities of faith when you actually are referring to religion, implying that other communities are not communities of faith, is deeply destructive to the task of common coexistence. Why? Because it sets up a distinction that does two things. One, it tends to insulate religious belief communities from others. And secondly, the flip side of that, it suggests that these other communities and other people are not believers, not people of faith. And it tends to play into the biggest dichotomy of all, the biggest false dichotomy, which is that of the secular being somehow stripped of beliefs. A new belief-neutral realm. Religion and the secular is, in a sense, a really more recent usage of the secular than was understood historically. I've written about this at some length, about the origins of secular and the terminology of secularum. Secularum being the age or the times. And in the Christian traditions, we get glimpses of an older usage of secular, in which secular related to the world as opposed to the cloister. In the world rather than in the cloister. The cloister oriented, its telos being oriented primarily towards eternity, whereas the work in the world being oriented towards the temporal affairs. But neither were non-sacred. So within the Catholic tradition, the clergy in the catechism are divided into two categories, secular clergy and regular clergy. The secular clergy are the clergy in the parishes, and the regular clergy are the ones not in the parishes. Now, similarly, secular institutes within the Catholic tradition are those institutes working in the world. The definition reads, to further the sacramental life of Christ, the sacramental work of Christ in the world. Completely sacred in character, but secular, in terms of a different understanding of secular. Now, all this is to say that if we speak about religion and the secular, as we do, what we do is we divide religion out of the secular, in the same way that the separation of church and state can tend to build in a division where cooperation overcomes it. So what I'd like to suggest is that these false dualisms, these false dichotomies, are in need of rethinking, and we should start with that first proposition. All citizens, all human beings are necessarily believers. The question is, in what? Now, if you build upwards from that starting point, you end up in a very different place than if you start off talking about the state being secular, Canada being secular. Because what that tends to imply is there's no place in the public sphere of our lives as citizens for religious belief. So what we see is we have a tension, because at the moment, our law admits of the argument I'm trying to make. In other words, our law allows religion to have a public dimension. So I'm going to go to that to start off. The section of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms that protects religious freedom is section 2A, which speaks of the freedom of conscience and religion. The preamble speaks about, whereas Canada is founded on principles that recognize the supremacy of God and the rule of law. Conjunctive use, and. Rule of law and supremacy of God. If you argue that the supremacy of God is a dead letter in Canadian culture, because of the use of the linking of it in the preamble to the rule of law is conjunctive, you're also arguing that the rule of law is irrelevant. And no one argues that. So it's being called the embarrassing clause in the Charter, the supremacy of God. No one really knows what to do with it. But there are two recent articles in the literature in the last few years that urge a rethinking of the place of the preamble in Canadian constitutional law, particularly around that phrase, supremacy of God, because they say it provides a check on an arrogance of positive law unchecked by any other frameworks. I just offer that as an observation. There are two recent, one this year in the UBC Law Review, 2006, a long article talking about the embarrassing clause and how it needs to be rethought. So in other words, the preamble in the Canadian Charter, the discussion surrounding it, is not over. It's just the beginning. I just came from a conference in Montreal called the Charter at 25, because it's 25 years ago this year that the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms was repatriated from Great Britain, 1982. And so there's a lot of analysis here about this year about the Charter and its role in Canadian society. And the preamble wasn't mentioned at all by anyone. But I think in the years to come, as we start to think more deeply about law and its relationship to history, how law is itself checked by principles bigger than itself, that little phrase that was brought in to the Charter, the supremacy of God, will in fact be poked and prodded and maybe have something useful to say to us. But section 2A, conscience and religion, is also a conjunctive use. So what we say about religion, we also say about conscience. If you want to keep religion out of public life, are you also suggesting you want to keep conscience out of public life? No one argues that. But it's there to be argued that if you're arguing for religion to be entirely privatized and have no public traction, no public place of relevance, you're also saying that about conscience. And who would say that our religious, our elected representatives ought to have no functioning informed consciences in their work? No one would say that. But these kind of arguments about the nature of what we are as human persons, believers with consciences, informed by traditions, the most important of which for most of us is our religious beliefs, needs to constantly be held against this secularistic idea that the state is a realm stripped of religious relevance because religion is problematic for the state, therefore we must privatize it. The other place in the Charter of Rights and Freedoms that religion appears is Section 15, the non-discrimination provision. And Section 15 provides that everybody's equal before the law and has equal benefit of the law. And religion is one of the protected categories there. And it's easy to overlook that. Religion is protected in Section 15 not just for individuals, but for groups. And we need to constantly affirm that for our Constitution It is not simply an individual rights document. It's a document that also speaks about the place and importance of group identity and group rights. It's a community as much as it's a personal document. This is important because it's been a criticism of rights-based regimes that they can tend to be highly fragmentary and highly individualistic. And a rights-based framework can often drive the communitarian dimensions to the margins. Okay? So that said as introduction, nature of the, just a quick brush about the nature of the Constitution, how I'd like to urge you to view it against a different conception of what we are as human believers. I want to quote from the first case under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms dealing with the freedom of religion, and urge upon you that we need to understand that the rights of conscience and religion are public in nature, not merely private. Chief Justice Dixon, in the Big M drug mart case, which was the first case dealing with right of religion, and it was a challenge to Sunday closing laws, where they were struck down as having a religious purpose. He said this, "The essence of the concept of freedom of religion is the right to entertain such religious beliefs as a person chooses." And then listen very carefully to this next sentence. "The right to declare religious beliefs openly and without fear or of hindrance or reprisal, and the right to manifest religious belief by worship and practice or by teaching and dissemination." Note that the words employed are active public words: declare, manifest, practice, teach, disseminate. So those who wish to say that Canada is a secular society in which religious beliefs are private simply don't understand the law. They may be understanding where secularism as an ideology would like to drive the matter, but they're not accurately representing the nature of the law as we've understood it in Canada. The second point I'd like to make is that it's important to consider the nature of pluralism in Canada. Like so many terms in our public discourse, values, the secular, liberalism, its common use can mask the fact that it is little analyzed. As such, if there are presuppositions in the term or an ambiguous usage that is not discovered or discussed, we can be misled as to what is actually being said when the term is used. Now, pluralism can connote a kind of relativistic approach, as in, because we are in a pluralistic society, such and such a moral position cannot have any public validity. It does not have to mean this, however. And in Canada, our linkage of a language of pluralism with a firm commitment to group rights, for example, points us to a principle and what might be called structural or shared pluralism, rather than one that is relativistic, totalistic, or individualistic. For this is a notion of pluralism that views society as moving towards the articulation of one public policy. This is the idea of totalistic pluralism, or convergence liberalism. I'll talk about that in a minute. And this language of convergence, or one notion of what it is to be a Canadian, is antagonistic to proper notions of tolerance and diversity. The political condition in Canada respects the idea of a modus vivendi, a way of living together, despite differences of belief. As I pointed out earlier, the Constitution is not built upon the idea of individual rights alone. It's also built around the idea of group rights. And we're also not built around a liberal notion of individualistic rights. We're also built around the idea of Canada as an organic community, built up of organic communities that may develop their own approach to living together. So liberal individualism isn't necessarily the constitutionally required dominant form. These are things we run into from time to time when we have to deal with such things as communal societies like the Hutterites. And in leading cases in this area, the courts have had to recognize that there can be different ways of organizing freedoms that are respectful of different ways of living. And that's been hard won in Canada because our history has been somewhat inconsistent with respect to those kind of communities, as we've seen with the treatment of Dukhobors in Canada, for example, or others. I want to say a word about further word about secularism. It's been said recently, in very ill-considered reasons for judgment by the Supreme Court of Canada in a case in the early 2002 to 2004, a case called Chamberlain and Surrey School Board, that Canada is founded on the principles of secularism. Now, that was not argued before the court in that case. It was not part of the law being considered by the court in that case. And I think they're going to have to overcome that, because it's wrong in principle. Because secularism is an ideology, a particular ideology, has a particular historic form. It started in a particular year. We know who first said it and first published the term, 1851, George Jacob Holyoake in England. And when he coined the term secularism and wrote a book called Secularism Considered, English Secularism Considered, he set out a program for removing religion from public life. He talked about specifically removing it from politics, any influence in politics, and public education. And he set out that it was designed to replace life, the public ordering of life, as he put it, quote, on materialistic grounds, unquote, to get away from what he called the fantasy of religious claims. He wanted to replace point by point religious understandings of the world with material, rationalistic, as he called them, empirically verifiable claims. So this is the mid-19th century project of George Jacob Holyoake and then the English secularist Charles Bradlaugh and others who followed him, eventually forming the English Secular Society, to replace religion from public life, to get its, to reduce its relevance culturally. This has not been well understood. Dictionaries, even influential ones such as Encyclopedia Britannica and Encyclopedia, misread secularism and artificially claim that it was neutral, that it simply said was not opposed to religion, which was Holyoake's original claim. He said, we're not against religion, said Holyoake. But when you read his writings, Holyoake was opposed to religion and did point by point want to replace it culturally. So it's secularism sailing under false colors. And so judges can say Canada is based on the principles of secularism. But I think we need to recognize that's not true. Secularism is an anti-religious ideology. So we need to, in this paradigm shift of creating what we call a religiously inclusive secular, that is to say, a society that has a proper place for the beliefs of religion and doesn't put it at a disadvantage as against the beliefs of atheism or agnosticism, we need to understand that there's an ideology out there that's trying at many, many points to counter religious inclusion. Now, in Canada at the moment, some of these questions of how to deal with competing rights claims, religious groups in conflict with groups, for example, furthering sexual orientation claims. It's sometimes argued that the public sphere must give welcome and affirmation to the beliefs of certain kinds of rights claimants. I want to argue that we've got to be very careful about claims for public affirmation because of the nature of how we should deal with competing belief systems. And I want us to go take us back to the days when public education had religious indoctrination as part of its task. It wasn't long ago. It was only relatively recently that court decisions systematically removed Christian religious services from public education in Ontario in the various cases there and in British Columbia. And what we did as a society was we said, look, you can't have state-mandated opening exercises commenced each day with the Lord's Prayer or things of that sort, because not everyone believes that. So we removed that. We said that the way we're going to have peace in the public sphere, in public education, is to bracket out dogmatic religious claims. In other words, you can take your religion into the school as a person, but you can't expect others to have to affirm your religious views. And certainly the statutes and the school board rules shouldn't be pushing religious dogma. Now, I want to argue that some of the sexual orientation claimants are seeking to re-dogmatize public education along sexual lines. In other words, they don't just want to have respect as people with divergent beliefs. They actually want their beliefs about sexual conduct affirmed and taught in the public education system as what I would call sexual dogma. And yet, we understand that not every citizen is required to believe the same things about sexual conduct. We allow a diversity of viewpoints about sexual conduct in Canadian society. And around one of the most central things related to sexual conduct, marriage, we allow different communities to believe different things about marriage. One of the things I'd like to push around a bit is the whole question about whether marriage commissioners who happen to be religious and who happen to be opposed to same-sex marriage should be entitled to, in their public office as marriage commissioners, decline from marrying same-sex couples. Because that's now on the agenda for debate and discussion in Canada. And I think what I've been setting the stage for in terms of the nature of the secular as religiously inclusive and so on, and the law that we have in Canada related to accommodation of religious viewpoints, call us to examine the scope of religious dissent in relation to some of these new claims for public recognition. So if I'm right that sexual dogma should be ruled out of public education the same way religious dogma should be ruled out, then we may have an argument for how to properly share the public sphere that's more respectful of diversity of viewpoints and citizens than simply what we're facing now, which is the claim that affirmation of religious, of sexual dogmatic views by same people who want sexual orientation recognized in a full public way. That viewpoint recognition claim is, I think, going to cause tremendous friction in the years ahead, because I think it overreaches. And I think it's one thing to require respect for citizens. It's another to require respect for their beliefs. So there's a distinction, it seems to me, between the requiring the beliefs to be recognized and the person to be respected. Because it is not a rejection of the dignity of a religious person to rule out their religious dogma from public education. Similarly, it is not a rejection of a gay or lesbian person to rule out from public education the furtherance of their religious beliefs as sexual beliefs as sexual dogma. I think there's a strong argument there. It's not an argument that's being made publicly at this point. I just made it at the Charter Conference in Montreal. Nobody jumped up and down at the microphone and took it on, maybe because it's too novel, but at the point, I think we have to start thinking about it in that way to get the public conversation going, because at the moment it's not going. It's the conversation's being shut down by preemptive claims that if you don't accept my view of sexual conduct, if you don't accept our view of marriage and portray our marriages as normative, you are rejecting our dignity as people. This argument is on a collision course with the argument that says we are respectful of divergent views on marriage as a culture. Because to teach that same-sex marriage is acceptable is unacceptable to religious communities that reject it as acceptable. And it's simply not a claim under dignity to say that you cannot reject the claim for acceptance of same-sex marriage. You can reject my beliefs as a Lutheran without rejecting me as a person. Similarly, I would argue I can accept you as a person without accepting your views of same-sex marriage. Now, Justice Gauthier, in dissent in the Chamberlain case, the case out of British Columbia showing where same-sex parenting books were being introduced into the kindergarten to grade 2 curriculum, he wasn't disagreed with by the majority judges on this point. Here's what he said. It's a feeble notion of pluralism that transforms tolerance into mandated approval or acceptance. And further, the inherent dignity of the individual not only survives such moral disapproval, but to insist on the alternative risks treating another person in a manner inconsistent with their human dignity. In other words, to say I can't reject your beliefs on something is, in effect, to fail to accord you the dignity of disagreement. I think Gauthier is writing a very wise thing there. So in my paper, How to Live Together with Disagreement, one of the things we need to acknowledge is that disagreement is not the enemy of civil coexistence. It's how we manage disagreement, not whether we have it. Justice Gauthier went on to make the following remarks about the use and abuse of tolerance arguments. Remember, right now, we have all these arguments for equality being used, diversity being used, tolerance being used, in ways which actually, if they're worked out the way some of the claimants are using them, affect inequality, lack of diversity, and intolerance. So we need to get beneath the rhetoric of the claim to actually look at how it functions. In other words, we need to call a spade, and when somebody's saying, you have to, in order to accord me dignity, do such and such, or you have to, in order to be tolerant, do such and such, we're entitled to say, well, wait a minute, your conception of tolerance there is one size fits all. And Canada doesn't require that one size fits all on matters where there can be divergence of belief. And that's why when I appeared before the various committees of the House and the Senate on the same-sex marriage bill, I urged upon the different levels, building into the preamble of the marriage law, a statement to the effect that in Canada we allow a divergence of view as to what marriage is. So sure, if the government wants to change the marital law to include same-sex marriage, do it. But in the preamble and in the sections, build in a recognition that there are divergent views in Canadian society about the nature of marriage. And secondly, build in protection for those communities that are never going to do or want to perform same-sex marriages, because they are going to become, they're going to be challenged and they're going to be attacked for refusing to go along with this new orthodoxy. Or, as one author calls it, a new sectarianism, because it functions as a very aggressive form of cultural sectarianism. So Justice Gauthier, again, in talking about tolerance, says this: language espousing tolerance ought not to be employed as a cloak for the means of obliterating disagreement. The equality section of the Charter protects all persons from discrimination on numerous enumerated and analogous grounds, including the grounds of religion and sexual orientation. Language appealing to respect, tolerance, recognition, or dignity, however, must reflect a two-way street in the context of conflicting beliefs, as to do otherwise fails to appreciate and respect the dignity of each person involved in any disagreement, and runs the risk of escaping the collision of dignities by saying, pick one. But this cannot be the answer. In my view, the relationship between Section 2 and Section 15 of the Charter, that's the fundamental freedom of conscience and religion and the non-discrimination provision, this relationship between these two in a truly free society must permit persons who respect the fundamental and inherent dignity of others and who do not discriminate to still disagree with others and even disapprove of the conduct or belief of others. Otherwise, claims for respect or recognition or tolerance, where such language becomes a constitutionally mandated proxy for acceptance, tend to obliterate disagreement. I think Justice Gonthier is exercising in a profound way there the proper role of a judge in spelling out the concerns. He did a superb job in that judgment, in my view. So some commentators are in fact doing what Justice Gonthier warns about. They're placing a requirement of approval on the list of things necessary to respect the dignity of a person. And they do it in a pick one approach rather than what I call an exemption and accommodation approach. Sexual conduct, like religious belief, is a matter that should be essentially private, is highly contested, and cannot properly form part of the core notion of civic excellence without driving other conceptions, perfectly legal to hold, about human sexual conduct into the darkness. I've touched so far on pluralism and then secular. Now I'd like to talk about the third part of my paper, the fair treatment of differing beliefs. One of the key points here is a problem in the nature of contemporary liberal thought. In an important book written a couple of years ago called Two Faces of Liberalism, John Gray suggests that there are essentially two approaches to liberalism. In the first, disagreements are assumed to be way stations on the road to eventual agreement, and it's thought that emerging social consensus will eventually lead to a coalescence of viewpoints. Gray calls this the rational consensus approach. I like the term convergence liberalism, the idea that we're eventually all going to converge on agreement. This is hugely powerful in Canadian thinking about human rights and the Charter. And a lot of our equality cases implicitly are convergent liberalism decisions. They're decisions in which the court speaks about the court's role in furthering a movement culturally towards a shared endpoint. In the second viewpoint, disagreements and different beliefs are viewed as necessary accompaniments of living in a world of incommensurate and incommensurable beliefs and values. Here the search is not for eventual convergence, but for ways of coexistence, or as Gray calls it, the search for a modus vivendi, or ways of living together. Gray's work provides a sustained analysis of the dangers to genuine freedom posed by the idea that there's only one form, a monistic form, of liberalism itself. Gray suggests that the principles key to genuine liberalism must avoid one-size-fits-all approaches that foresee a common endpoint in society that can be driven by law and politics. Gray writes that liberal thought rarely addresses the deeper diversity that comes when there are different ways of life in the same society, and even in the lives of the same individual. Yet it is the latter sort of pluralism that should set the agenda for thoughts about ethics and government today. Liberalism contains two philosophies. In one, toleration is justified as a means to truth. In this view, toleration is an instrument of rational consensus, and a diversity of ways of life is endured in the faith that they are destined to disappear. The predominant liberal view of toleration sees toleration as a means to a universal civilization. If we give up this view, says Gray, and welcome a world that contains many ways of life and regimes, we will have to think afresh about human rights and democratic government. We will refashion these inheritances to serve a different liberal philosophy. He says we will come to think of human rights as convenient articles of peace, whereby individuals and communities of conflicting values and interests may continue to coexist. Gray cautions against the kind of what he calls illiberal fundamentalism that can all too easily hide what looks like a liberal approach to tolerance and diversity, but isn't. And listen to this. It is a mark of an illiberal regime that conflicts of value are viewed as signs of error. Yet liberal regimes which claim that one set of liberties, their own, is universally legitimate, adopts precisely this view. They treat conflicts amongst liberties as symptoms of error, not dilemmas to which different solutions can be reasonable. Liberalism of this kind is a species of fundamentalism, not a remedy for it. Now, William Galston, another scholar writing in this area and who was former policy advisor to the Clinton administration, who's written some profound things on pluralism and religion, he says this. He says, the accommodation of diversity within a determinate but limited conception of liberal public purposes is a better foundation for liberal philosophy than is the promotion of personal autonomy or rational reflection, however attractive these values may be to important professions and social classes within liberal society. Galston says that pluralist politics is a politics of recognition rather than construction. It respects the diverse spheres of human activity. It does not understand itself as creating or constituting those activities. Families are shaped by public law, but that does not mean they are socially constructed. What provides ways of agreement and civic discourse, if not our conceptions of the good and the civic glue to keep us together, is formed in many ways by our religious beliefs and our formations, not by government policy. Galston and others are starting to suggest that we need to focus more on these mediating institutions, these small platoons within civil society, as providing formative and differing conceptions of what the good entails, rather than viewing the state through law and politics as the means of driving a conception of the good. And it's right at this point that the contemporary challenges, right now framed between sexual orientation claims and religion, the way a decade ago they were on the abortion issue. Each age, but I'll just a quick parenthetical observation here as a lawyer who's been involved in these issues for 20 years. Each age seems to have a carrying issue culturally that frames the central debates philosophically. So in the 80s and 90s in Canada, it was the abortion movement. It framed everything in the law, from costs to standing to intervention rules and to how to share this public sphere in terms of hospital boards and so on. That's where all the disputes were. Now, do you remember that period? Remember how everything was framed sort of around abortion? Then the abortion issue fades as a main issue, and another issue, which my friend Paul Reed at Stats Canada calls the carrying issue of the day. The new carrying issue emerges, and right now it's same-sex rights. It's framing everything. It's framing the scope of trustees' decision-making, the scope of religious institutions' codes of conduct, as in Trinity Western, whether a printer can refuse to print materials, as in the Scott Brockie case in Toronto. Every kind of public dispute now is about same-sex rights. So the reason I'm talking about them so much today isn't because I have any axe to grind against gays or lesbians. Heaven forfend, I don't. But I'm pointing out that those debates are where the vivid coal face of the philosophy is being formed right now. That's where it's happening. On the other hand, this is me speaking, and with respect, the Chief Justice's formulation tends towards a monistic or totalistic conception and is quite contrary to that kind of political pluralism referred to by John Gray and William Galston, in which there's a vision of social space and spheres of autonomy that must resile from claims to be a comprehensive good. On this reading, the Chief Justice's conception of law asks too much when it views itself as larger than the religious and other conceptions alongside of which it must operate. In her response to the Chief Justice's address, University of Chicago professor Jean Bethke Elstein said this, quote, "Surely, where the rule of law in the West is concerned, there's a great deal about which the law is simply silent. The king's writ does not extend to every nook and cranny. Indeed, a great deal of self-governing autonomy and authority is not only permitted, but is necessary to a pluralistic constitutional order characterized by limited government. In other words, the law need not be defined as total and comprehensive in the way the Right Honorable Chief Justice claims." Unquote. Now, with great respect, the way forward for constitutional adjudication in certain cases is to abandon entirely or significantly narrow the notion of the law's role in aid of forcing the approval of certain contested social conceptions, with the implicit or explicit idea that we shall sooner or later come to agreement. It may be that the Chief Justice herself has not finally settled the relationship between law and religion and the individual. And she may already have come to a richer understanding of the relationship between law and religion than that articulated in her 2002 speech. Because, in one of the Supreme Court's more recent decisions touching on religious liberty, a decision called Amsellem, the Chief Justice noted that both the state and the law should be reticent to delve into personal matters related to the nature of religious belief. Because, now quoting her, the state is in no position to be, nor should it become, the arbiter of religious dogma. Accordingly, courts should avoid judicially interpreting and thus determining either explicitly or implicitly the content of a subjective understanding of religious requirement, obligation, precept, commandment, custom, or ritual. Secular judicial determinations of theological or religious disputes or of contentious matters of religious doctrine unjustifiably entangle the courts in the affairs of religion. Unquote. Now, Gray was correct to speak of a kind of fundamentalism in the claim for comprehensiveness. In the West today, no religions can or do claim priority over plural politics. Yet in the formulations I quoted above, the Chief Justice, and in the writing of certain academic commentators that one can read, and in the writing of Professor Janet Gross-Stein in a recent and widely noted Literary Review of Canada article, these commentators have been suggesting that there are principles that are bigger than religion that can draw all the way down to religious communities to control them, driven by the law. These approaches are comprehensive claims of the type that John Gray says pose a threat to ordered liberty. Law and human rights are for all citizens, religious and non-religious. So the framework of both law and human rights ought not to be set up as a de facto replacement religion in some supposed non-religious secular, however tempting it may be for some to view them in this way. We must not accept any longer the idea of a secular, that is, ipso facto, stripped of religious influence and religious believers. The separation of church and state should be recognized as relating to a structural separation between the jurisdictions of what are properly matters for the state, law and politics, and for religions, on the other hand. We must be careful to keep an institutional and a personal analysis separate. Thus, to hear, as one does frequently in politics, that a particular politician must keep his or her religious views out of their work as a politician is a category error. Beliefs of whatever sort necessarily frame the work of all human beings in one way or another, and atheists and agnostic politicians have no special privileges in this respect. Of course, the manner in which arguments are made, based upon beliefs, is another question, and those have to be carefully thought through, so that in one's public role, they make sense to a wide variety of citizens. The personal beliefs of many important politicians who may have been strong theists owed their galvanizing power not to say their gospel pronouncements, better left to the pulpit, but to the ability they had to speak persuasively about the common goods affecting all citizens. Thinking here of Lincoln, or even Tommy Douglas, in the old CCF articulations. So those were the points I wanted to make this morning. This evening, I'm on a different time.
It's morning.
Yeah, for me it's morning in France. Tomorrow morning. Those are the points I wanted to touch upon, and I hope they set up a rough framework. I'd like to get to the marriage commissioner issue, and maybe we can deal with that in the question period. But I think we need to have, just by way of concluding comment, we need to have less fear of disagreement and more openness to accommodation. That's how Canada has to proceed. Because at the moment, this driving, grinding everybody into one-size-fits-all public articulations is, I think, extremely dangerous for liberty and very dangerous for religious communities. So, thank you.
The way we've shaped this is that Dietmar Mundel, my colleague here at Augustana, is going to open up several avenues of conversation for us. I don't know how long Dietmar will be. He has that rich German Lutheran tradition.
4 minutes.
And then we will enter into a conversation about it. Initially, the three of us, perhaps, a little bit to see that there is real clarity about these matters. And then we'll invite you to join us in that discussion together. So, Dietmar.
Whatever is your pleasure.
Yeah, I think we should do it, and then we'll be more in a conversation mode. Yeah. Because otherwise I'll hold forth in a good Lutheran fashion, so this way. I'm limited by the reality of the fall. So thank you again, that was very insightful. And of course, I've read some of your previous reflections on that. And the things that I should, for those who don't know, Ian's work has been focusing on law and constitution. That's not my world. And so when I look at the issue of living together with disagreement, and secularism, pluralism, and the fair treatment of belief, I think of my classrooms. How does that play itself out? Because, and that's one thing what I liked, actually, the last main point, is that the law is a very blunt tool. And I think we have to find other ways, other than the law, to effectively deal with how do we understand and appreciate difference. And maybe rather than simply living together, I think tolerance is a very weak word. Well, Ian, I'll tolerate you. I don't bother to understand you. I don't want to hear your argument. I'll just tolerate, who you are. And, I've tolerated David for a while.
It's not been easy.
I know, it's been tough. But, we're just going to have a motive, and we're just going to sort of live side by side. And so rather than tolerance, I would say, well, to live with disagreement means actually the otherness of either your mode of thinking or David's mode of thinking or any of my students' mode of thinking is also a way for me to reopen and re-examine and research, what is the truth or not that I'll have an ultimate truth. So it isn't that I'll end at a convergence model. Okay, now everybody in the class agrees. But I hope at the end of my class that I have grown by listening to the students, and I hope that the students have all at least, to use Gadamer's phrase, sort of had an experience of the fusion of horizons. That doesn't mean we come to the same, but it means that I start saying, okay, now from your framework and what you value, okay, this makes a lot of sense, right? But if I just stood at my standpoint, okay, I'm a teacher, you're a lawyer, so the never the twain shall meet, then I can never get to that place. So I have to be able to enter into your way of valuing. Just to give a concrete example, for the last 11 or more years, we've exchanged over 240 students with Mexico now. And Mexicans coming here, our students going to Mexico, and we live a whole academic year together. And it is pretty useless if our students simply go through a Mexican village, which becomes their home, and say, well, that's not very tidy there, and, boy, I have a better shower at home than this bucket bath that I'm taking here, and if they were only developed, they would have such and so. And in fact, my aim of taking them into the Mexican village is that they can learn from Mexican villagers who live in a very different world. So it isn't that they are aspiring Canadians or aspiring, whatever. They, North Americans for them are U.S. citizens, but okay, they're not aspiring U.S. citizens and living in that kind of consumer life. They are living genuinely in a very different world. And my hope is, I can't do it very well in teaching, but by taking people to live and have a family that they are eating, drinking, dancing, doing all the things, singing with, that their understanding gets broadened of, in fact, diverse ways of living in this world. I think it is, in fact, monoculture is very, very threatening. And so that's what I really appreciated about what you were saying, that we don't want a monoculture, we don't want to force one version of life on everybody. But the alternative isn't let's just live in little islands. Not that you're saying that, but legally you're saying, well, we basically can live in our own islands, And then the question, and maybe you can explore that a tiny bit more, is at what point is something in public discourse a dogma? You know, you use the language religious dogma and sexual dogma. On the one hand, you're arguing religion should not be privatized. And then we hear, but that dogma should be privatized, and religious dogma should be privatized. Everybody's a believer, so I have a certain belief about sexual conduct, so that I should privatize that. That shouldn't be part of the public realm. So I'd like a bit more clarity on, when is a position dogmatic? Is that a bad thing in itself, to have a dogmatic position? You know, and in our culture at least, dogma is bad, spirituality is good, or whatever. So are you talking about two competing absolutes which are unassailable to either conversation, sort of a deeper understanding, mutual, so beyond I respect you, but I disagree, can I go further? Or is the dogma that gets in the way, and is the dogma something absolute? So, you've used an interesting phrase about the ultimate. And for me, the ultimate is not available as absolutes. If God is the ultimate, the Endgültig is the ultimately valid, but I never have or can control God, and neither in a secular, ideological version nor in a religious version. So how the distinction between ultimate and absolute might be an important one. So that whole issue around dogma. The other things that I really appreciated, and that's, I've been teaching religious studies here, both in Christian higher education and in the public university setting. Both were university. We just shifted ownership from church ownership to public ownership. And so within that, yes, I'm always trying to have students reflect on the fact that, in fact, you can't get up in the morning unless you have some version of faith. And now let's examine, become conscious to ourselves, what is it that we are actually believing? And so I think that's very strong, that you're arguing the way secular is used is very often ideological, namely in terms of secularism. But what I'd like you to hear a tiny bit more about you, though, what is the strength of the secular? So the secular state, meaning simply not controlled by a religious group,
or the civil.
Yeah.
Maybe the civil state.
Yeah, okay, the civil state, exactly. So what is the strength of a civil state rather than a religiously, dominated state? And that would help a bit, even in dealing with the boundary issues. Okay, so you say, we've wrestled with church and state, they can cooperate, but you say, law and politics have a limit, or law and government have a limit. What is the limit of religion then, on the other hand? All you indicate is we should privatize certain things, but I'd like to hear more. Okay, what is the limit? So the church or religious communities or any belief community, because everybody's a believer, so all belief communities have a responsibility in the civil sphere to try to shape our understanding of the common good or, of our social enterprise together. What is the limit of that? And then on the other hand, what is the limit? When is the state interfering with religion, belief communities, cultural communities, etc.? So those would be some of the things. So can we move beyond tolerance or just living side by side to a deeper engagement with one another? And then what is dogma? And then how do you, what are the limits, of, what the state or law and government can do and what religion should do? But and I'll turn it over to you after that. But I think an important issue still, and I wasn't totally satisfied, that if I'm trying to introduce a perspective that hasn't been, you say we have multiple views on marriage in Canada, okay, and that's now in the preamble. How would I discover that in school, and how can I discuss that in school? Again, going into my classroom, I have, gay students, straight students, Muslim students, Christian students, Buddhist students, agnostic students, atheist students. To me, the issue would be, present it. Present your view, present your reasoning for it. Ideally, in fact, what I try to do is have people who are gay or who are in a gay relationship speak to the group so people understand, so they can ask questions. Then people who are in in healthy or non-healthy, you know, whatever, heterosexual marriages, express that. Have somebody who's an immigrant from Ghana, for example. We lived in a polygamous Christian family. It was actually a pre-Christian family when we lived there. It is now a polygamous Christian family, because you don't just dismiss your wives and abandon them, because the family is the social welfare and the network. So they are protected by the laws. So share, what is it like growing up in a polygamous family in Ghana? And how did you deal with that as a Christian, for example, or as an animist, or whatever your tradition is? So for me, again, it's not just saying, okay, that's private. No, let's bring that into conversation, because we have to actually hear. For me, that's an important thing, to have mutual understanding. Otherwise, I'll say, oh, I'm heterosexual, that's my view, you know, and since I'm the prof, I can sort of control a bit the conversation, you know, in the class. Anyhow, so that would be the other issue. But anyhow, I'll let you respond first, and then David might want to jump in.
Did you want to make any points first? Or?
No, okay. Please, just walk into them.
No, you've made very good points and raised some extremely important qualifications and questions. Tolerance is a weak word. That was your first point. I agree with you. It can tend to be a way of... It can be used in a way, though, that's very, very aggressive. In other words, mm-hmm. It can demand acceptance rather than simply a hearing. There's a lot wrapped up in what you've said. First of all, you asked the question, at what point do we get dogma? At what point do we morph from religious viewpoints into dogmatic proclamation? Mm-hmm. I think the key thing here is setting. Dogma is fine if we understand by dogma those central beliefs and teachings which give identity to a community. There's appropriate places for the proclamation of dogma and inappropriate places. So the religious believer's capacity, as in Big M Drugmark, to profess, teach, disseminate, manifest, those are not unbounded, because obviously in public education the right of religious belief does not give the right to religious indoctrination.
Right.
Okay, so already in the law we recognize a limitation on the public profession dimension of religious belief. I would say that the setting is everything. In other words, let's take a lay pastor who is also a public school teacher. They always have the right to be public about their religious belief, but how they're public about it and what is everything, and what it's appropriate to profess as dogma in church is not appropriate to profess as dogma in the public classroom. Similarly, the same-sex activist who holds what I would call a dogmatic position on same-sex conduct may have a capacity to articulate that in one way in one setting and in another way in another setting. When we get to the public classroom, I think there the conflict between dogmas, competing dogmas, requires a high degree of sensitivity to diverse viewpoints. And it's there that I think where our language of tolerance doesn't really help us, because of course the claim isn't just tolerate me, it's affirm me, give me social recognition, welcome, and indeed celebration. That's the language that's being used by some of the claimants.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think their capacity in that analysis to recognize setting restrictions, if you call them that, setting contingent rules, it needs to be refined. So now the other thing you said, in that you were using your students discussing same sex. Remember that in the Chamberlain case, we're dealing with kindergarten to grade one, grade two students, and the role of parents in relation to the education of children. By the time you get to university, the role of the parents is considerably diminished in terms, you know, the person in the classroom is an adult agent. Therefore, again, setting provides some of the contextual framework for analyzing the rules. But in a public school, I'd like to see much more sensitivity to this principle of the parents as primary educators of their children, and then a greater respect for the diverse beliefs of the different parent groups. However, that in a public school setting doesn't go all the way either, because some parents in exclusive religious settings or in certain anti-religious, atheist or agnostic communities may not want their child exposed to anything that the rest of us might consider basic. For example, that there may be other family forms than simply heterosexual marriage, or that there are other religions that exist, may be things that some types of people simply don't want their children exposed to. And it may be that there's an irreducible minimum of material in controversial areas that we have to come to decide is essential for basic civics. But in determining the content of that, we have to be extremely attentive to the belief systems that are in conflict. And we cannot get everything we want from public education. And I think that we have to step back from some of the claims for affirmation in public education that different groups are seeking, either religious or sexual orientation based. So I don't think it goes as far as some people would like it to go, or as far as the court may have suggested it should go in Chamberlain. I think they under-recognize the role of parents in Chamberlain. And I think the result will be catastrophic for public education, because parents who are not properly listened to in terms of their beliefs will walk. Home education will boom. Private education, insofar as they can afford it, will boom. Arguments for fair funding will lead to the establishment of different systems, and the capacity of the government to use a public system to inculcate shared beliefs will diminish.
Is this part of your concern?
Yeah.
Is it part of your concern that you see this overextending of law as having this deleterious effect on something like public education?
No, absolutely. Entirely on culture itself, including public education. I see the overextension of certain group claims into the public through force of law as leading to fragmentation generally and suspicion. I see it driving people further out of a sense of confidence in a shared respect framework. I think that's what's driving a lot of parents' moves to home education. They no longer buy into the curriculum. They view it as an instrument of governmental control, and they remove their children from it. Insofar as that happens, there's a twofold diminution. One, you lose the common civics capacity of public education. And secondly, you further the removal of children from the idea of coexistence with those with whom they're not in regular subcultural contact. So I think sociologically it has profound implications. This overreach ends up literally fragmenting common culture.
And it makes it less likely that you have to learn to live with difference.
Yeah, that's the irony of it all, is that the claim that it will, that the use of the common system controlled by law will produce this move towards understanding ends up working backwards. And I think the actual way to produce a much more mutualistic culture is actually through involving the diverse communities of belief that make it up, not using convergence liberalism to try and affect it through control of the public system. So I think the manner in which we have control of the public system now is working precisely backwards against the intent of creating a shared culture.
So it's to heighten in those contexts, to heighten the variety of particulars. Variety of particular perspectives, the variety of religious, ideological perspectives.
Yeah. Inappropriate ways.
Inappropriate ways.
Yeah, see, the risk here is always the principle of subsidiarity is really important here.
You'll have to say a little bit more about this. Not everybody is a Catholic.
Well, it's not, and the principle has other terms.
Luther left.
Sphere sovereignty, mediating institutions, respect for the small, The larger exists for the benefit of the smaller, not the other way around. So that the subsidium, the smaller unit, has its is furthered in its function by the radiating circles of the larger units. So parents, primary educator of the young, delegate to the larger sphere their primary authority. Larger sphere, respectful of their authority, works together with parent groups to form a system. The local schools, in dialogue with the broader schools and ultimately with the Ministry of Education, are all working together to help in the primary task of the family educating its young. If you flip it around, the state dominates everything all the way through, and the rules are dropped from the top down with very little input from the parents. And that's what we have. Because we've lost the primary understanding that the education is to further the community and the community's task of educating its young. So what happens is that you actually end up disenfranchising the very people for whom the systems were built in the first place. So it's a failure to attend to the ordering of these systems that leads to there's just so many implications from this problem. I used to live on a small island for many years off the west coast of Canada. And our road widths were determined by a provincial highway set of regulations that were not built with attentiveness to the community. In other words, this small island had any new roads that were put in were huge, way, way too big. They were ugly, they were expensive.
Destructive.
They were not done with attentiveness to the needs of the citizens. Now, what needed to happen was greater dialogue between different levels of government, attentive to the particularities of the place, as understood by the citizens in dialogue with ambulance services, fire departments, etc. But we don't do that. What happens is we have a provincial system that drops the rules all the way down, and it's one size fits all. And the result is it doesn't fit. So, Now living in France, where I see a much more attention to local decision-making. For example, all of our community design work is done out of the mayor's office. And you have a mayor's office in every little town in France. So that if you want to build to make changes to your property that are going to affect the community, the decision is made in the community about that. Now there's pluses and minuses to this. But there, one doesn't want to be too, Pollyannish about it. But it is interesting, though. It keeps the decisions at the level of immediate determination and at the human level of conviction and change. So much of our lives in the contemporary world have been damaged by the decision-making being removed from our capacity to actually influence it. In education, I think we really need to start doing what they're starting to talk about in some countries, which is to make it more locally accountable. And it for all kinds of reasons. Now, another question. So, a dogma, what it is and how it should be restricted and how it should be encouraged, mm-hmm. depends on setting. You ask, what is the public dimension? You know, what is the... When I'm saying that a person has a right to be religious in the public. There is a case a couple years ago of tremendous importance. It got a lot of press coverage at the time. It's called Brocky. Mm-hmm. Scott Brocky was a printer in downtown Toronto, ran a print shop, did a lot of work in the fashion industry and stuff, had a lot of gay clients. But he never asked what their sexual orientation was, but he did a lot of publications for the fashion industry. He assumed they were gay. It didn't matter to him. But he was a born-again Christian. He dedicated his business to Christ, etc., etc. One day into his boardroom comes an organization and says to him, we want you to print our materials. And he says, okay, what do you want? Business cards, letterhead. And they hand the materials across. And it's called the Gay and Lesbian Archives. It's an organization set up to promote gay and lesbian history and self-understanding, etc. And he says... You know, he's a businessman, not a sophisticated human rights wonk who understands the rules. He just says, I've got a problem with this philosophically, religiously. I'm not going to do this for you. It's cordial, but he refuses the print job. They go up, the group, the guy goes off, representing the Gay and Lesbian Archives, he goes to the Ontario Human Rights, and he files a complaint. They have a hearing. The commission, which can appear before the tribunal as a body, brings in experts. They bring in the former moderator of the United Church of Canada, who says, we don't have a problem with homosexual groups or conduct. We think it's really important. This guy isn't United Church. He's an evangelical of some sort. The commission wants to make to show that Christianity isn't unanimous about this. So it applies the general debate about homosexuality to this one individual. It's not an individual subjective assessment of his beliefs at all. He's subjected to some kind of abstract standard. Anyway, the long and short of it is the tribunal also hears from noted academics that are brought in as witnesses. And they say that there's a cycle of invisibility amongst gays and lesbians. It's very important for them to have affirmation in the public sphere. For their suicide rates are high because they have such a diminished sense of self-worth and so forth. They need to be made more visible. The tribunal ends up writing a decision saying that Mr. Brockie is entitled to his religious beliefs in his home or in his church, but when he steps into the public sphere, he has a duty to support the laws of the land, which in human rights must affirm the need for the increased visibility of gays and lesbians. They fine him $5,000. They order him to print those materials, and not just those materials, but any materials brought to him by that group or any other gay and lesbian group. Well, those of us who read that decision thought, that's interesting. I mean, you're making a citizen who's got an objection to something into an instrument of state policy of advancement of another group against which he has profound disagreement. How can that be allowed in a free and democratic society? So we, you know, a couple of us wrote some articles on this, and I got a phone call. I was asked if I would do the appeal. So I took the case. And in doing the case, we argued on the appeal, what he hadn't argued at all before the tribunal. I'm not sure it would have got him very far anyway, because the tribunals are what they are. But he argued on appeal before the Ontario Divisional Court that any citizen, no matter what their beliefs, has an ability to function according to those beliefs, with certain exceptions. You cannot say to somebody, I will not do work because you're black, or because you're religious, or because you're gay. But you can say to anybody, I will not do this work because I disagree with your project. You see the distinction?
Mm-hmm.
Now, so we said, it would be a terrible wrong for a society to force feminists to print pro-life materials that they object to. It would be a terrible wrong for a society to order a Jewish printer to print materials for Hamas, or for a Hamas printer to be forced to print materials for a Zionist organization, and so on and so forth. And by parity of reasoning, it is a wrong to order Mr. Brockie to print materials for a same-sex group that he disagrees with.
Your point here is the reach of the law.
Yeah, that the subordination of individual conscience and religion to state policy in this setting, to advance gays and lesbians over the backs of people who object to that as state policy. And the Ontario Divisional Court agreed with us. They narrowed the decision of the Ontario Human Rights Tribunal, struck down its remedy on him having to print those materials or any other materials. They ordered him to print those materials because they held they were innocuous. They were just business cards and letterhead. But they missed the point. Just business cards and letterheads for a project you're totally opposed to is obnoxious. If I'm a Jew, I shouldn't have to print anything for Hamas. So the court, in its attempt to be Solomonic, ended up really messing up the principles. They did rule that if he could find print materials that were objectionable to his core religious beliefs, he didn't have to print those. So a gay pride parade materials, presumably they really didn't have to print them. We don't know because they didn't spell that out. But it's clear now in the law in Canada, and the decision cited all the time, that if you have a core religious objection, you don't have to print those materials. Or if you're a person who has a core conviction. It can't be peripheral, it has to be core. But here, they also did two other things. They left the fine in place, even though he won the major principal. Then they awarded him costs, as if he'd won his case. Then the cost award was appealed to the Ontario Court of Appeal. I was the counsel on the cost appeal. And he lost. So he got his costs award removed, even though he won the case. So Scott Brockie
sounds very Canadian.
Ends up being a victim. He ends up being a genuine victim of a seriously unjust set of procedures.
Now, Ian, if I could just probe this a touch.
Yeah.
I don't know your position on this, but the argument, one of the arguments that lies at the foundation of this, that there is a need to address in our society the kind of prejudice and marginalization that has existed for gay people. Is your point here that law, in this sense, is not an appropriate instrument for addressing those matters?
Where there's a properly justiciable legal claim, employment, a good one would be employment. If I fire somebody from a job because they're gay or lesbian, that's got to be wrong, in my view.
Mm-hmm.
There's a legal right not to be fired for a job because of your sexual orientation or your religious beliefs or your race. That's right, that there's protections like that. So I'm not nothing in what I'm saying ought to be taken as suggesting there shouldn't be legal protections for gays and lesbians. My concern isn't with that. I mean, of course there should be.
Mm-hmm.
Your question is, should the law be involved in the advancement of social recognition for groups? And at that
is
point,
the law an appropriate thing to
use? I have real concerns about that because I think the law must be set up as a protective mechanism against unjust actions, either by persons in a human rights context or the state in a constitutional context. But when the law is turned around as a means of advancement, it's going to necessarily make invidious claims against groups who disagree with the kind of advancement that's being sought. For example, in the Scott Brockie case, it was seen as perfectly acceptable by the Council for the Ontario Human Rights Commission to argue that his religious rights were entirely privatized. Now, that was the state speaking. That's the Ontario Human Rights Commission, funded by tax money. So my concern is that when the state is put in the ideological driving seat of advancement, it will tend to ride roughshod over subordinate communities. I don't want the law doing the task of that should be done by people. Citizens.
And how should citizens or people do that?
Well, gays and lesbians are not known as unable to organize well. Gay pride parades are amazing civil events when you think about them. And they are all designed to increase advancement, recognition, etc., etc. Fine. I have my problems with ordering civic officials to proclaim gay pride parades. I think that's a good example of the problem of the law being used around an event. The event should be allowed, but the law shouldn't require the event to be proclaimed. Do you see the distinction? I think, now let's get to the Marriage Commissioner's case, because it provides us a particularly keen example of this.
Because those are moving into a slightly different realm. The state promoting recognition that we've been wrestling with, recognizing Quebec as a distinct society. Do you see that as a parallel overstepping of, Anglo-Canada by and large hasn't liked it because they had a procedural understanding of the law and constitution, whereas Quebec says no, for the survival of us as a distinct culture, we need to preserve our culture, and therefore we need laws to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Is that a parallel or not?
No, it's not a parallel.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a parallel because it's a different scale and it extends to an entire culture.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the whole question of Quebec identity is a linguistic community across a huge span. including gays, lesbians, religious, non-religious, every citizen, is a kind of Grundnorm shift or reality needing legal definition. Distinct society clauses are a statement about the nature of the whole cultural set, okay, including everything in it. So you're really talking about a constitutional survival recognition. It, that doesn't raise the same problem of invidious classification that I'm concerned with in this other case, where you're choosing between citizen groups, kinds of advancement, and so forth.
You see, so you should share that from your commissioner.
Yeah, well, you see, that doesn't. So your point, it's a very fine question about Quebec, but I think it's distinguishable on the ground that it's an entire culture you're talking about. That doesn't get us over the problem of the extent to which you can use that generalized principle to subordinate minority groups within Quebec, so that you still have to, in Quebec, deal with the rights of linguistic minority groups. And that, and there you would use the law as a means of rights protection for groups who may find their own distinctive aspects bleached out by the overarching requirement for distinct society recognition. So it doesn't get us over the problem, but it does. So it's not. But I don't think it's analogous. Now, marriage commissioners. In light of what I said earlier about the secular being religiously inclusive, in light of what we know about human rights protecting individuals, we have to approach the marriage commissioners question on without subordinating the individuals who are marriage commissioners to a blanket, one-size-fits-all conception of the secular or the public realm. Now, in some of the legal commentaries that I've read recently, the statement is made that at the minute that somebody has a public office, they must do, they must profess the public rule, they must provide the public service in an undifferentiated manner to anyone who seeks it, and therefore their personal viewpoint is completely subordinated to the public purpose. Now, does that sound familiar? Yeah, it's the Brocky case again. It's taking the citizen with a twist. It's Brocky with a twist. It's taking the citizen. In Brocky, the citizen was being subordinated to state, to the provincial purpose. In the marriage commissioner case, the deemed provincial purpose is being used to subordinate the office holder in terms of their personal beliefs. I think what we need to do is recognize that marriage commissioners are like doctors who are have a public function insofar as they're paid by the public purse, but don't lose their ability as citizens to have their religious beliefs respected. So doctors, under this code of the CMA and under the Canadian rules, can refuse to perform abortions. Abortions are legally available in Canada. But we don't use that general legal availability as a club hand on the conscience of the individual physician.
So one size doesn't fit all.
Exactly.
There's options.
Right.
And you can exercise them.
And I think there should be that for the marriage commission. In fact, as I did in Brocky, flipping the example around to show how it works, if I had, for some reason, a gay marriage commissioner who was ideologically opposed to heterosexual marriage, but we didn't know it, and that person is now a marriage commissioner who doesn't want to marry heterosexuals, I say fine. Fine. He may not do a lot of marriages, or she may not. But the point is, our conscience and religion protection, it's not that goofy. And you know, we may find that this doesn't just end up as a homosexual thing. We may end up, if polygamy becomes legal in Canada, we may find that there's a lot more people objective forms of marriage that have become civilly acceptable than simply the same-sex marriage question. And we ought to find ways and be able to find ways to accommodate the conscience and religious views even in the public realm of people like marriage commissioners. And that's where I hope we'll go with our principles.
So, there's a few little things to chew on here. Would somebody like to, we'll spend a few more minutes, like to enter into it?
Yeah, report I take this as non-directional. Or?
Yeah.
Yeah,
well, we're recording it, so it'd be nice if we had you on there. That's fine.
I think, yes, it's true.
It's fine.
We have a lot to chew on. One of the, I guess, as a lawyer too, looking at this, but also
I'd have known that.
Yeah, okay. but also wanting to look more in depth into going beyond law, beyond ethics, into sort of the moral and theological. Looking at how the law is being used by some of these activists to pursue their claims, pursue their issues, pursue their agenda in terms of wanting affirmation, acceptance, forcing then other people to have to believe what they believe, even though they don't in conscience believe or agree with it. Do we not see the state becoming the witting or the unwitting, I'm going to use the word dupe, as part of this establishment of a public morality, and therefore getting us to the issue of, should the state be allowed to establish a public morality, which was always the realm of the church and faith and various religions? Should the state be allowed to establish that public morality, and therefore, and if not, how do we as individuals then try to restrict the state? Because ultimately, what was the charter about? Restricting the state against incursions against the individual. But it's being used to do that in these cases. So are we not at a point where we have to establish ourselves in terms of being activists and saying, wait a second, the state stops here in terms of establishing a public morality, almost maybe a public religion, if we try to elevate this issue of secular to a belief system, which I find is a dangerous sort of thought, because it elevates it to a religion, it elevates it to the same level. When people, you know, that gets into the theological. I could go there for half an hour, but I don't want to at the moment. But do we not think that the problem here is the state establishing public morality? Well, and therefore, that becomes problematic against us as individuals, where we need to protect ourselves from that establishment by the state.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is, can this, in this state, by state, we have to be clear what we mean here, state is law and politics.
Yes.
It's the formal framework.
Yeah, I'll accept that. Yeah,
that's society is the, are the people around.
The politica, yeah.
Yeah. Those are important distinctions. But yeah, the state, can, when the state sets up its law and its law on matters, criminal code, et cetera, it doesn't just establish morals by what it does. It establishes the moral flavor of the culture by what it doesn't do. So you can't avoid a moral result from the state's action and inaction. That's the really paradoxical thing.
No matter what it does.
No matter what it does.
Yeah.
To act, to be inactive is to, in fact, act.
Yes. First we must do nothing, yes, Minister.
So, well, it's a paradox, because the moral nature of a culture is determined as much by its inactions as by its actions.
But in these cases, are they not? They're not inactions. They are actual, definite actions in terms of the decisions coming down through the state system, through the
court. Well, the complexity here is that it's that the laws are subject to the decisions of the judiciary as well, and those are not controllable through the state as politics. The state as law is determined through the exigencies of judicial decision making, which is not controllable. It's more controllable in Canada in theory, because we have the override clause under our charter, but everyone's afraid to use it, so it's kind of at the moment it's dormant. But follow up on this, if you look at the, if I understand what your point was, I'm not sure I did, frankly. I don't have its epicenter, but you did make this important point about public morals.
Yeah, that was it.
You're concerned about public morals, but I would say that your concern is in some ways valid, in other ways not, simply because we are going to have a moral culture of whatever sort by virtue of the way we live together as human beings. A nihilistic culture dominated by by merely self-seeking individuals who want only pleasure is going to have a, that will have a moral effect on us all, irrespective of legislation in regards to it. So we're stuck with it. So the state, the idea that you don't want the state involved in morals, in a way, it's unfortunate, but the state is involved in morals. The question is, how is it going to be informed about the nature of those morals? And that's the very interesting question that I think brings in the role of religions and the role of community groups. And
in terms of cooperation with the state, you mean?
Well, in terms of what they tell, what they teach, you know, what their voice is, what they say. You know, the civil rights movement is a good example here. The beliefs of the citizenry are prior to its rights, by which I mean what citizens believe and articulate about and jump up and down about will frame the nature of the rights culture that results from it. So the civil rights movement very clearly emerged from religious understandings on the parts of civil rights leaders. We were knocking this around a bit earlier with David. But if you look at Gandhi, Gandhi's religious sensibilities influencing the policies that he and his followers followed in India, Martin Luther King in the States, the religious insights that are at the core of the, you know, early suffragettes even in the women's movement or any of these great social movements, it's they're being driven from the ground up, not from the state down. The state eventually gets implicated, but it's the beliefs of the citizenry that end up influencing the moral culture that speaks ultimately through law and politics. So that politics ends up being responsive to movements that originate from the beliefs of citizens. And that's why the state, at its peril, restricts and weakens those bodies from which its ideas of maintenance emerge. We don't want to weaken the place of religions because religions are what check our common life most richly at the end of the day.
So the state needs to nurture difference.
Yeah.
For its or at least survival. Allow that difference to flourish.
For its own
survival. For its own sake. Yeah. For its own civil survival.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. I was just one thought in terms of the, you mentioned about the judiciary.
Yeah, can you make us your question short?
Sure, yeah, I know.
Sorry,
I didn't realize there were people crying. Sorry, thank you. In terms of the judiciary, yes, they, in terms of control, but ultimately they're controlled by the laws which come through from Parliament, which, as you're saying, are influenced by the public. So ultimately we can deal with the judiciary, but it is a rather roundabout route.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah. And a long one, too.
Thank you.
Please.
Yeah, thank you. I would just remark, I appreciated that you used Professor Elfstein's quote to introduce the idea of the importance of modesty, of the modesty of the law. And because I agree with you that there is a tendency in the state towards overweening, mm-hmm. Over the private sphere. And my question is, how practically can we go about regaining the modesty of, you know, the idea of a state that will limit itself, and of a law that is innately modest? And back to where you mentioned the sort of the origins of the common law, where liberty is the primary state. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it a matter for activism? Is it a matter for education? Is it a matter of just individually living our lives in that way? How practically would you go about regaining that modesty?
Yeah, that's a very good question. How do we regain the appropriate sphere and jurisdiction of the law in politics? Well, I think one aspect of it is education. I think that, you know, a lot of people are educated now into what we might call the Charter of Rights model, in which the law is viewed as in expansive terms as furthering furthering justice. That's the dominant model in Canadian law schools. It was dominant at the conference I just spoke at in Montreal. You know, there's this real, you know, cheerleading kind of rah-rah sense that the law is going to affect, bring about the just state. And I think what we need to do is point out that justice, in real terms, is only facilitated by limiting justice in positive law terms.
Otherwise, you're millenarian.
Well, otherwise, you end up overexpanding the role. You end up overreaching, as you said, the role of law in politics, neither of which are competent to create the conditions of culture for their own maintenance.
Yeah.
They end up being... See, the really interesting thing is that the substance of the cultural survival is cannot be driven from the top down for a variety of reasons. The life, in the common life of the citizenry, is what makes the culture around it, including law and politics. Law and politics must never be used as a means of ordering the entire life of the state, because they don't have the competence to do that.
Yeah.
Now, how do you, in a circumstance where we've got these overly ambitious expectations of the role of law, the way to reduce it is to constantly and effectively and articulately point out its deficiencies, the deficiencies of that model. And I think that work of contemporary philosophers on liberalism like John Gray and William Galston, Jean Bethke Elstein, in contradistinction to people like Chief Justice McLaughlin, as she was in 2002, because frankly, I read a lot of her clerk at the Times work in that, who's a writer who's written some other things that are consistent with her view. And she may not have that view deeply built in, and it may be possible for her to shift off it, as I think her recent decision shows. She isn't. She's a work in progress. But I think we need to start educating students and lawyers and eventually judges about the more humble nature of law and the limitations of law within nation building.
All right,
thank you.